was lying on a floor, a hard floor, because he was staying in a tent when he was evacuated out of the hospital. And that caused pressure sores. And you might have heard of these terms, because if somebody is not being taken care of, because when somebody had the bilateral hip fractures and he had the external fixators, so he was lying stiff because of lack of painkillers on a hard ground, and he can't even move right, left, and he developed pressure ulcers. And nobody, because his elderly parents were not kind of, you know, able to look after him, those pressure ulcers changed into the deep ulcers, and he developed cavities up to his pelvis. And the pus was pouring out of his pelvis. And when I saw him, I literally cried. A young 28-year-old reduced to bones. And I knew what was coming, that he would literally die in the next few days. And this is what the malnutrition and this can do. And this was I was witnessing in patient after patient. And this is just not one example. But I put this one example to tell you guys, kind of, you know, this could be the impact and this could be. So don't take it light. It could be. And to witness this and to feel helpless, that was even more painful. And this is, you come across and you see as a plague. Every other patient you will come across, there will be patient after patient like that. And, you know, there were 30,000 refugees who were staying in this hospital, and you walk around them and you walk with them, and children, and kind of, you know, they were just reduced to bones. The child whose bullet I removed, which I was mentioning to you before, when I looked at the x-ray of that child, there were clear evidence of malnutrition. You know, the bone kind of, you know, demineralization, and you could clearly tell the signs as a medical kind of, you know, that this child is malnourished. The child has not been eating or kind of, you know, having proper food. So there are so many ways why I could not only just see, there were clinical proofs, you know, the x-rays and many other evidence which could confirm you and give you an evidence kind of, you know, that these people are malnourished. And this was having kind of, you know, a devastating effect on the whole kind of, you know, picture, because complication raised sky high kind of, you know, and then they were not making any progress. It was not heading in the right direction kind of, you know, no matter what you do, it was just not the outcome what you want them to kind of, you know, basically achieve. The not only just the food and water kind of, you know, deficiency, there was basically pretty much shortage of every medication or any drug or equipment you could think of. You know, there were no anesthetics. At times we had to do amputations without anesthesia or under local anesthesia, and then we ran out of local as well, and then we had nothing basically. Antibiotics, severe shortage. You know, when you are dealing with these sort of a chronic infected wounds, you need a good kind of, you know, antibiotics. First of all, you know, there are no capability for the lab to give us the good culture results so that we can know what exactly bugs we are dealing with and what we can tackle them. Then lack of antibiotics. And we were dealing with really aggressive, multi-resistant kind of a wounds with fungal infections and whatever you could think of was growing in them. But there was no way to tackle and manage with all of them. And there were no equipment, supplies or medications to kind of, you know, deal with them. In terms of in theaters, so sometimes we struggled even to have sufficient sutures and medical supplies, like you know, even simple day-to-day usage stuff, you know, to clean the wound, to make it antiseptic kind of, you know, to clean the skin, swabs to control the bleeding. I'm a vascular surgeon, and I was and being the endovascular experience, I was able to work in the cardiology lab to do some angiography and those procedures, but we did not have sufficient catheters, wires and things, because for example the renal patients, because of the lack of food and water and other supplies, they were getting dehydrated and hypotensive, and their fistulas were getting thrombosed. So when their fistulas get thrombosed, they were put in with different sort of a lines kind of, you know, and these lines were to sustain, keep them going so that they could have their dialysis. But as a result of a side effect of this lines was that they were getting narrowing in the blood vessels in the on top of the heart. But when I was asked to go and treat those narrowing and to open them up, I didn't have the equipment. There were no wires, there were no balloons. How can you do that? So it was a challenge after challenge due to a number of these factors, and we just kept building on. And we were just not allowed to take in kind of, you know, these medication. And then more recently, I've come across a situation where particularly the pediatric ward, which is mainly based at the European General, they need some special equipment in the terms of the pacemaker, some urology equipment, and some other basically kit to help the kind of, you know, children. But none of them has been allowed to go in. The hospital itself, it runs on the special generators to run the hospital 24/7. because the electricity is not available. It only runs on those generators. Those generators have missing parts, and often there would be like a blackout in the whole hospital all of a sudden because the generator has stopped working. The spare parts are not being allowed to take in for that. So it's not only just one. The each and everything, whatever you pick, there is a problem in that, basically. So the problem was quite extensive in summary, basically.
If anyone has any questions.
What do you anticipate will be the long-term growth and development outcomes for children growing up in Gaza today? Anticipated life expectancies?
Very bad, in one word. Because right now, the Gaza has become a culture or a medium for only death, badness, disease. Because an environment has been created in which if their normal life expectancy before was like 70 years, right now I would say it would be definitely reduced to easily much less than that, like maybe 50 or even less. And the reason for that I'm saying this is that it is an observation, because I'm not an expert on that area and I do not have those exact stats, and it's very difficult to get the exact stats in Gaza, but this is an observation. For example, I give you like nearly more than 85,000 tons of TNT has been bombed in Gaza. And Gaza is much, much smaller than, kind of, you know, if you compare it to London or any other big city, yeah? So there are significant environmental factors which have been, because the whole Gaza has been changed into a culture in which the chances of the future cancer and so many other diseases is going to go sky high. And because of the malnutrition and other factors, the children which will be born, they will be underweight, they will naturally not able to grow, and they will have so many other diseases. So the whole thing has been changed into a culture in which only badness can happen. And this is why we need to act rapidly and open this humanitarian corridor and try to rectify and correct these things as soon as possible. Otherwise, what I'm using the word annihilate, it is a simple way to simply completely annihilate this community.
Dr. Junaid Sultan, a cardiovascular surgeon based in Hull in the UK, speaking at a side session at last week's Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, focusing on Israel's destruction of Gaza's healthcare system. At another standing room only session, Raji Sarani pounded his fist on the table, calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable for its crimes in Gaza and Palestine. Raji Sarani is the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights.
We are killed with American European bombs. It's not an Israeli bomb. Till this day, till this moment, they are not only defending their genocide, they are giving them the arms to kill us. They're giving them the money to support their economy and to continue with their crimes against us. There is a real serious problem. That's why we want not the mood and the behavior of the state to decide. We want the rule of law. The alternative, it's the rule of jungle, the powerful, the mighty, who can set the rule? I mean, Gaza, very, very serious this case. What do you want? Do you want Gaza and Palestine to be the graveyard of international law, international humanitarian law, or not? You have to answer, not we, the Palestinians. The ASP, I mean, should answer that. The free committed people through the globe cannot be hostage for 4, 5, 6 states. Who takes, you know, all this international legal system and want to destroy it, want to vanish it. And it's Kafka. I mean, when you see the complicit, the partners, the criminals who are threatening the justice system in the world, I think that's the added value for the ASP in this session, to speak truth to power. And that's the message, I mean, we are trying to convey. We, as part of this world, what would we want?
Raji Sarani is the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. He was speaking here at a side panel at last week's Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We'll link the Palestinian Center for Human Rights at greenplanetmonitor.net. Dr. Junaid Sultan's presentation at last week's Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the ICC in The Hague. Panel Chair Mira Nasir, legal officer with the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, asks Dr. Sultan a question.
Dr. Sultan, I'll ask you one final question before opening it up to the audience for any questions. Since returning from Gaza, you've done quite a bit of advocacy. You've given interviews about your experiences, and you've tried to push government officials to secure a ceasefire. Can you please tell us a bit about this advocacy since your return, as well as what the response has been from government officials to you sharing what you experience? And also, what do you want to see from both government officials, but also for the future of the healthcare system in Gaza?
So I felt, when I came back, I felt like it was my moral obligation, and my mission would not have been completed if I would not have done that. Because, and the simple reason for that was the complete silence. A silence across all the circles of the kind of, you know, like mainstream media at the government level, and there was absolutely no acknowledgement of what is going on is wrong. And I felt like that I have to be the ambassador of Palestinian people and basically get their voice out. As you know the situation, that there are no international media and there are no any official of, from any government who has been allowed to go inside Gaza to find the ground facts themselves. So we as humanitarian have been put in such a unique position that along with doing our humanitarian work, we are the only source of connection among the local Gazans, civilians, and the healthcare workers at the outside world. And I think it was very important for us to do this responsibility and get their message out and show the world that what they are facing on day-to-day basis, all the atrocities, war crimes, and their voice needs to be heard. So based on that, I started kind of, you know, working on that, and I particularly focused on advocacy. I must say there was a huge reluctance. Anywhere I approach, from the mainstream media to medical journals, anywhere I go, nobody was ready to talk about Gaza. It was a simple full stop. Nobody would just, you know, say, oh, you want to talk about Gaza? Okay, yeah, we will think about it. That's fine. But I will not kind of, you know, even hear back. All I want to talk about is just to share the ground facts, what I saw, and I just want to report that. And after a lot of efforts, pushing, I managed to get some interviews in the mainstream media. And you, if any one of you have seen those, and the first thing which I said to most of the people, and I invited the government officials, even representatives, to come with me and let's do a mission together. Come with me and just be part of our mission and just come and see the facts yourself. And I even invited mainstream media to kind of, you know, come and just follow one of our missions 24/7 and see what we are witnessing, what we are doing, and do the investigative journalism yourself and share those ground facts. And Piers Morgan actually straight away said to me that, first of all, I'm too scared, I don't want to go. And second, he said to me that, you know, Israel won't even allow me. So naturally, the environment in Gaza has been created so dangerous that nobody wants to go in there. And secondly, what kind of, you know, the a complete barrier and separated it from the outside world. And that barrier needs to be stopped and uncovered. And this is what I've been keep saying in the multi-stream, in the mainstream media. In terms of then government officials, it was another like hitting the head with the basically brick wall. And wrote started with simple things, writing to the local MPs, and stuff, and nobody wants to even reply to you, nobody listens to you, take any kind of, you know, action on that. Then we escalated further, and very kindly 30 of our humanitarians who have been to Gaza in UK alone. So we decided to write a letter to the government, and ICJP kindly helped with us. And we asked them to take simple measures like, you know, do the ceasefire and stop arming, kind of, you know, providing arms to the government of Israel, and open the humanitarian corridor. Basically, you know, just provide the healthcare officials and the civilians with the aid what they need, and provide, kind of, you know, open the human corridor on unconditional basis, basically. Simple things. And surprisingly, but I should not say kind of, you know, but we did not have any reply for weeks. And then finally we had a reply from the Minister for Common Wealth. And the reply was even in a very half-hearted way, and the questions which we raised, they were not addressed in that letter, basically. So we are trying to organize some more parliamentary meeting sessions so that we can, actually we have already organized, and ICJP help us as well, and we did even provide direct evidence to the MPs, to the government officials, what we saw and what we witnessed. And what that I find it very difficult to understand, but when all the evidence is in front of you, all the testimonies are there, and we are asking you to come and verify yourself, then why that kind of, you know, is not being taken opportunity, and why it's not being done. So something is not right, and that is each and everybody's responsibility to talk about that why, and keep questioning this, and do not stop on that. That would be my take on that. The future of medical professionals and healthcare is in extreme danger in Gaza right now, and I would like to particularly talk about it because hospitals are the site where the young doctors, medical students nurture and they grow, and they are the future of that kind of, you know, community or that healthcare system. And right now those hospitals itself been completely decimated and destroyed. So there is pretty much hardly any hospital is left which is working and doing anything. Then on top, more than 1,000 healthcare professionals have been killed. Some of those healthcare professionals were with a wealth of academic and clinical knowledge and experience, and some of them were only unique in the sense that, you know, there was only one histopathologist in Gaza, and that has been killed. There are only 2 working vascular surgeons in Gaza right now for a population of more than 2 million. So these are the sort of, kind of, you know, experience which has been stolen from Gaza. Who will train their young ones? Then if you come to the junior level, the 2 medical universities and schools, they have been completely destroyed. Medical students have no medical school to go to, no hospital to go to train to, no internet access to go online train, and no electricity, no houses. They are living in tents with bombs falling right and left of them. No security, a psychological impact in things. Same situation with the junior medical doctors, and those junior medical doctors are exact same position like the medical students are. And those junior doctors are actually getting phone calls by anonymous numbers by the IDF, and they ask them to leave Gaza. Mm-hmm. And they are threatened every day to stop working and do not come to the hospitals. And if they won't, their families, they are already under there because they know where everyone is, and they are scared that they will get bombed in the tents outside. So by this way, it is a very systematic way to destroy the healthcare system of a community, to completely annihilate them. Because you can save yourself still to an extent from bombs and guns and stuff, but the level of damage which you will cause by using healthcare as a means of warfare, that is unexplainable. That has an impact like a nuclear bomb. It will completely annihilate that community, and that's what is being done, and that's what you guys need to understand and protect and stand for it, please. And this is what I'm here to request you for that.
Once again, Dr. Junaid Sultan, cardiovascular surgeon based in Hull in the UK, speaking at a side panel at last week's Assembly of State Parties to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, focusing on Israel's destruction of Gaza's healthcare system. Read more about Israel's destruction of Gaza and its hospitals and the work of physicians like Dr. Junaid Sultan at greenplanetmonitor.net. it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Bombardé d'informations erronées de tous parts et il est difficile de savoir à qui faire confiance. Vous pouvez faire confiance aux voix que vous entendez sur cette station de radio et sur d'autres radiodiffuseurs communautaires. Nous avons besoin de vous pour écrire à votre député local pour lui expliquer pourquoi la radio locale est importante pour vous. Rendez-vous sur monirc.ca et découvrez comment vous pouvez contribuer à protéger l'avenir de la radio communautaire.
This is Bird Note. Along the coast of Sinaloa in Mexico, there are species of shorebirds with one of the longest migrations in the Western Hemisphere.
Se reproduce en Canadá y llegan a las costas de Sinaloa, a estos sitios de granjas de camarón, en números muy, muy abundantes.
They breed in Canada and arrive at the coasts of Sinaloa to spend the winter, says a shrimp and shorebird conservation specialist named Juanita Fonseca. Sinaloa has more than 400 miles of coastline in the Pacific coast and the Sea of Cortez. There, Juanita works with the Western Hemisphere Shorebird Reserve Network and with Manomet, creating guidelines that help shrimp farmers share the coastline with shorebirds. One of those shorebirds is the Western Sandpiper. And the sandpiper, here known as el playurito occidental, wants to eat. But their wetland habitats are affected by the shrimp farming industry. Juanita and other researchers want to see how and where these shorebirds travel, to learn which habitats need more protection.
Es una especie de interés para los canadienses, con la cual nosotros hemos colaborado con ellos y trabajado con esta especie por el número que llega acá a estas costas.
It's a species of interest for Canadian biologists who collaborate with Juanita and her team to preserve their wintering grounds in Sinaloa. She is saying. And they do so by creating spaces within shrimp farms for the playurito to eat. This show is part of a series on Manomet shorebird conservation research and it's also available in Espanol. Visit our website birdnote.org to learn more. I'm Camilo Garzón.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Radio Rewind.